This is HPR episode 2568 entitled, Personal Finance. It is hosted by Klaatu and is about 55 minutes long, and carries a clean flag. The summary is, how to manage personal finances.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Hi everyone, this is Klaatu. You're listening to Hacker Public Radio. This episode's about my least favorite subject in the world, money, specifically personal finance. I'm doing this episode not because this is an interesting topic to me. In fact, this is one of those topics that I've really shy away from in lots of different ways. I don't like money. I wish it weren't necessary. I don't enjoy having to make money. I don't enjoy having money. Money is something that is just, it's a somewhat necessary evil, I guess. And eventually you have to think about it. The problem is that a lot of us don't think about it. And when we do research, there's a lot of conflicting information about it. And generally advice on this topic comes in two different forms, at least from what I've seen. One, the first form is the form of someone scolding you for not having saved enough money yet. If you'd only saved a penny every day since you were 12, then you'd be a millionaire by now. That sort of advice. The advice that you cannot take action on because it's something that you have not done in the past. And then the second form of advice, in my experience, is the very urgent sort of dictatorial, these are the things that you need to do, but then there's never any follow-up on how to actually do those things. So this episode seeks to remedy that. This is a clueless person, i.e. me, speaking to you with advice pretty much gleaned from lots of mistakes. In other words, this may not be the best advice. In fact, this is definitely not authoritative financial or legal advice. That's probably an important disclaimer for me to make. Do not listen to me, but if you want to listen to this episode, take what I say and then go and do research on it and make informed decisions. Although I challenge you to actually do research on this stuff because I'm telling you, nobody ever talks clearly about this subject. So hopefully this episode, if nothing else, will be the clearest conversation about personal finance that you will ever hear in your life. Okay, so there's a couple of different problems about personal finance. First of all, okay, well, we'll start with a really, really low level. First of all is, what if you don't have any money? Like, how do you get money? Where does it come from? How do you acquire it? How do you hang on to it? How do you manage it? How do you save it for the future if you can barely pay rent now? Okay, that was my first quandary back in my college days and trying to figure out how I could get into this business whilst making below minimum wage at various stupid retail jobs. I wasn't making literally below minimum wage, but minimum wage is not a living wage in the USA, at least. And so it was a little bit of a quandary. I mean, I could literally sometimes not pay rent and my school bills at the same time. So you had to make a choice. So you're going into the negative no matter what. So my choice at that point was to drop out of school, save money by not going to school. That was the smartest choice I've ever made, and it's one that I highly and heartily recommend to people. But I recognize that not everyone is going into an industry where they just kind of don't even ask about the degree in the first place. So that's not always going to be something that you can do. So maybe you have to go to school, and maybe you're working, maybe you're not working, maybe you're going into debt. But generally speaking, and you'll hear this from a lot of people, but I'm going to have to say it, but I'm going to say it with a few more notes that hopefully will make it actually mean something to you. And that is, in order to live a healthy financial situation, in order to have that in your life, the key is, and I know you've heard this before, but the key is to spend less than you make. And I know that that sounds trite and really, really frustrating, especially if you're living in a place and you think it's pretty much the worst place that you could possibly find. You're living in squalor, perhaps, and you still can't pay your rent. So you think, well, gosh, Klaatu, that's awfully trite because I am living in poverty and I still can't afford stuff. So what do you propose that I do? So here's what I propose that you do. depending on your situation, possibly stop living in an apartment for a while. I've done a whole episode series on living, on being voluntarily homeless. And one of the side benefits to that is that you have almost no expenditures. I mean, you have to be cognizant of it. You have to say, okay, well, this is why I'm doing this. I'm moving out of an apartment right now so that I can eliminate rent so that I can then save that rent. So in other words, you can't do it and then spend all your money on beer at the pub, you know, because that cancels each other out. So if you're doing it for savings, then you have to actually follow through and make sure that you are saving and follow that money, track that money and see that it is adding up. If it's not adding up, then the cause and effect is not working and you need to change tactic. Another way possibly is to get roommates. I know that seems like an obvious thing, but for some reason, for a long time to me, that was not obvious. It took me way too long to get roommates. I mean, on one hand, it's a chore trying to get a roommate that doesn't trash your stuff and frustrate you and make your life miserable. It really is quite a chore, and even finding a roommate. But at certain times, it's a beneficial thing to do. At least purely financially, it's a beneficial thing to do because you're splitting costs and you can cut that rent bill in half, like literally in half, possibly even less. I think part of the thing about that whole tactic is getting rid of your stuff. Like if you have a bunch of stuff, if every time you move an apartment, you have to rent like a U-Haul and you're finding yourself struggling with money, then you might have too much stuff. And if you get rid of stuff, you will find yourself much more free to sort of explore cheaper options. So, you know, if you can find dirt cheap rent by just crashing on someone's sofa and throwing them, you know, a little bit of money every week, and that's the only semblance of an apartment that you have, is you get to sleep indoors on that sofa for $25 a week versus renting an apartment for $500 a week, or would that be realistic? I don't know what U.S. prices are anymore, but you know, whatever amount of money that would be, then obviously it's very intelligent. But if you've got like two sofas and a bed and a wardrobe and all these other things, then it's a lot harder to just say, hey, I think I'll just move into this, you know, I'll just crash on this person's sofa for $25 a week. Because now you've got all this, you know, you've got an apartment full of stuff, so where are you going to put it? I mean, you could probably put it in storage. In other words, what I'm trying to say is think outside the box. Really think about how you can cut prices or cut costs no matter what. And I know that people's situations are different, and if you have maybe a child or a family, then that sort of thing becomes a lot more difficult to be flexible with. And sadly, I have no experience with any of that. So I have no advice. That's how that works. So that's kind of the base level financial thing, right? The principle is to realize that if you spend less than you make, then you are okay. I mean, some people say you're rich if you do that. That's a lie. But you are definitely not, you're not living, you're not in debt at that point. Well, you may be in debt, but not from your expenses. And that's kind of how you can get out of debt, is by spending less than you make and then taking all that excess money that you're no longer spending and dumping it into the big hole that you dug at some point in your life that is your debt. So that's how that works. It's not easy. Sometimes you have to make huge, huge sacrifices. Like at one point in my life, believe it or not, I had no internet at my home. Yeah, I had no internet bill. Like, I know a lot of people think, well, that's not possible. You cannot do that in the modern day and age. But it is actually possible. You cannot have the internet at home. You can go to places with the internet and do things like you can check the internet. You know, you can check email at a cafe or whatever, and it works. It works perfectly fine. You can do that. You can set up an account on a free server and use that as kind of a check-in point, like a VPN sort of thing. You can do all kinds of cool things, and there's no internet bill there. You can have no TV bill. You can get used books for really cheap. You can play games. You can do lots of things to entertain yourself at home that do not involve bills. So really think outside the box. Reduce the cost of living such that whatever you are making, however, you know, regardless of how little or how much that is, that you are not spending more than you make. Okay, so sorry if that seemed super basic and not very informative. Like I say, most of us have probably heard that advice before, but I think it does bear repeating, and it does bear repeating with an action plan. That's how you do it. Think outside the box, eliminate bills, do whatever you have to do to get those two columns balanced. Okay. So the bigger problem, the long-term problem, I think, that really made me think to do this episode, is retirement. How do you save for retirement? And do you even need to save for retirement? For a long time, I figured retirement was but a myth because, frankly, I don't really have any sense of how anyone can plan for retirement or how that's being taken care of at all or how that will ever come to fruition. I just figure I'll be working for the rest of my life. Like, until I die, I'll probably be working. Now, lately, I've kind of come to think that maybe I don't want to work until I die. Like, maybe I don't literally want to die on the job. Like, maybe I want to have like a couple of years buffer between working and going home and saying, okay, yeah, it's time to die now. Okay, so retirement in the USA, of course, is the conventional wisdom there is that Social Security is your retirement plan. There's a program in the US, it is called Social Security. So if you ever hear an American talk about their Social Security number, that's it. That's there was this system that developed, I think, somewhere after World War II. I think, don't quote me on that, Social Security, and it was this thing where you would send the government money and they would tuck it away for you into a safe little place. And when you get to a certain retirement age, which of course is a flexible number, it isn't something that's hard-coded into our DNA. It's just the number that the government called out and said, hey, at this age, we will start taking the money that you sent us for in your Social Security account, and we will send it back to you at intervals. And the idea is that you're investing in the US government and that they would keep that money in their bank, essentially, and it would be acquiring interest and it would be growing. I mean, they'd be spending and stuff, but I mean, it would be in their books now. And so by the time that you are, you know, 70 or whatever it is, then all that money has accrued and grown and compounded and all this other good stuff, and now they'll be able to send it back to you in Social Security payments. That's the idea behind Social Security. Now, there's not really a guarantee that when you retire, there will be a Social Security account anymore. Like, I mean, it's this program that the government started, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It just means that it's something that was promised. But I mean, as we all know, promises are not always delivered upon. Debts are not always paid. If there's no money in the Social Security bank account at the end of it all, when you're not the end of it all, but like when you're ready to retire, then you're not going to get those checks. And it'll be, I'm sure, very embarrassing for the government, and they'll have to kick their feet in the sand a little bit and apologize. But I mean, what are you going to do? That's just how it's going to be. And that might not ever happen. Maybe they've been safeguarding that Social Security money really, really well, and it's all guaranteed. And when I get to retirement age, I will be getting a Social Security check. Who knows? Now, part of the Social Security thing is, though, is that there is an expectation that you've been paying into Social Security. Now, a lot of us don't really, we're not very cognizant of Social Security. Americans, we're not, I mean, we know that it's a thing and we know that we pay into it, but there's not really a great, at least that I've found, there isn't really a great system of sort of keeping track of Social Security. It is very abstract. It's very sort of separated from us. So maybe they send you statements, maybe they don't, maybe they can't catch up with you. I've moved all over the place, so I have no idea what's going on with Social Security. And yeah, so you pay into this thing, and I'm not entirely sure that you have any good sense for like how you're doing. You know, it's very difficult, at least in my experience, to set a goal, a logical goal, and say, okay, by the time I am this age, I should have this much money in my Social Security. And if I don't, I should probably work harder to get more money into that. And even then, once again, there's a sense here that you've been on top of it from, you know, 15 or 16, whenever you were eligible to get your first job. Now, whether or not you were able to get your first job at 15 or 16 is up in the air, right? Maybe you didn't have a car. Maybe you didn't have an effective way to get to a job. Maybe you had other things that you thought were important at that age. Maybe people were telling you, don't get a job, work on your school stuff so that you can then go to college. And then you go to college and you discover that that's super expensive. And so now you think, oh, I should have just gotten a job, but you didn't. And all of this is in the past, so it doesn't matter. In other words, what I'm saying is that Social Security is not necessarily something that you, unless you're very good at managing your Social Security and you found ways to track it and you have been contributing to it very regularly, it may be something that you don't want anyone to count on. Maybe it's something that you could think of as a great bonus that might possibly appear when you turn 70 or 80 or whatever the age is. But it might not be something that you want to just assume, well, I know that I contributed to Social Security from, this year to that year, so it'll probably be like $1 million by the time I'm 70. You know, there are no numbers associated with this typically. Very difficult to kind of wrap your head around how well or how poorly your Social Security account is doing. And it's a little bit difficult to manage it because, like I say, it is a bit hands-off. It's just money that gets sent away to the government. And as far as I know, there's not really like a login site. You can't log into your account and look at the number and then add money to it. You know, if you have, I've got $200 set aside, you know, that I didn't spend this month. That's pretty cool. Just send that to my Social Security to get that. You can't do that as far as I know. Maybe there is a way. Hey, if you know about all this stuff, you should be doing a Hacker Public Radio episode because me and lots of other people would probably love to hear about this. Okay, so what are your options if you either have no faith in Social Security because maybe you haven't been contributing long enough, or maybe you just don't believe that it will actually be there when you hit 70 or whatever it is, or maybe you don't live in America and there is no such thing as Social Security where you come from. I mean, don't get me wrong, I got great instruction on how to format a business letter for in Microsoft Word 95, but not so much about what a bank was and how to interface with that and how to make sure that you're not spending more than you're making and all that other good stuff. I'm not really ever clear on the priorities in the American school system. But anyway, I digress. So people often say, you should save for retirement, but they generally forget to tell you how that is possible. How do you actually implement that desire to save, to put away money for the future? So for me, there are, or as far as I can tell, there are two levels or two methods of direct investment in yourself. And by direct, I mean where you can have the money more or less in your control. You can track it. You can see how much it's making. You can add to it. You can, in an emergency, I guess, maybe withdraw, that sort of thing. Like there's a very direct relationship between you and the money that you are trying to ostensibly put away for the future. Again, if there are other ways, then by all means, do an HPR episode about this because I think it would be great information to have. So as I've already said, I've mentioned Social Security. That's not very direct. Another fairly indirect method. So this is not one of my two direct. This is another indirect method, at least from my point of view, is a 401k. A 401k, again, very specific to America. And don't worry, I am actually going to talk about other countries here. But for the 401k is an American thing, and it was the government, as far as I can tell, sort of like everyone had lost confidence in Social Security and the concept of Social Security. And so businesses started offering these things called 401k plans. Nobody really knew what a 401k plan is. All you know is that it's magic. It's the great savior of Social Security. Sadly, it's quite abstract and fairly indirect unless you take great pains to take a very active role in tracking it and managing it. It apparently can be done. The 401k, there is sort of an interface to interact with it a little bit. And I didn't find out about this interface until probably 10 years after I first got a 401k plan. Some employer of mine in college, I think, had like some kind of 401k plan. And if I recall correctly, I did sign up for it because everyone was telling me, you should probably invest or save up for the future. So I did sign up for it, but apparently I never put any money into it. Or if I did, that money has since disappeared because it's not there. But yeah, apparently the 401k plans are kind of, as far as I can tell, they're kind of the free enterprise version of a Social Security. And so they get put into these big mega banks like Fidelity, for instance. That's a big one. And if you go to netbenefits.org, you could probably discover whether or not, first of all, you actually have a I'm sorry, it's not .org, it's .com, netbenefits.com. You can find out possibly whether you have a 401k plan at all. You might not find it on the website, but you might be able to call Fidelity and give them all your information, your Social Security number, and name and all that other stuff, and they can look up to see whether you actually have a 401k plan. And they may be able to tell you whether it has money in it and that sort of thing. And if you sign up with netbenefits.com, then you can sign in, and I think you can look at your 401k and kind of like see how it's doing and that sort of thing. It's all very, very direct feeling, but in my experience, it has been very indirect, very hands-off. It's kind of like, don't you worry about what is happening with your money. We've got it. You can't really interact with it. Maybe you can look, but sort of keep your distance. So that's a very indirect method of saving for retirement as well. That being said, I essentially have no 401k. So it may be brilliant in other people's minds. It might be like, this might be serving some people very well. All I'm saying is that if your workplace says, hey, we've got 401k, then first of all, make sure that you're like eligible, because I mean, whatever the hiring department says doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to ripple through down to your pay grade. You know, like I've been at a place that had a 401k plan. I am almost sure that I had signed up, and years later, when I finally look into it, there's nothing there. So, you know, kind of if you're going to go that route, and even with Social Security, if you go those, if those are your plans for the future, then you have to take a direct and conscious effort to track them, to look at them, and to understand them. And that's not easy. They don't make it easy. They make it very difficult. I mean, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, like they don't want you involved. I'm just saying they do not effectively, if they are trying, they do not effectively make it easy. It is very difficult to understand these plans. Now, there are alternatives to these things, Social Security and 401k, in other countries that are a lot different. And I didn't know about these until I moved to another country. And so I'm going to kind of do lip service to those and just kind of tip my hat at them, just so that you understand that Social Security and 401k does not, they, it doesn't actually have to be as mysterious and indirect and hands-off and confusing as at least I find, and a lot of people that I know find them very confusing. It doesn't have to be that way. So, for instance, in New Zealand, there is a thing called KiwiSaver, Kiwi Saver, KiwiSaver. If you are a Kiwi citizen or permanent resident, you can open a KiwiSaver account. And it is essentially, maybe not essentially, it is, I think of it as a 401k plan, or you could think of it as Social Security, but I think it's more like a 401k plan, because what you do is you have a job, and your employer may or may not, as I understand, contribute some extra money into your KiwiSaver if you contribute. So you can put up, I believe, up to 8% of each paycheck that you get. You can put, and I think that's net, not gross. I think that's like before taxes and everything. You can put 8% of your income into your KiwiSaver account, and then your employer may or may not match some portion of that. So they won't put another 8% in, probably. Maybe if you're putting 8%, they'll put another, you know, 100 or 200 or 400. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, and I don't know what the rules are. I know that my current employer is quite good at that, and they put quite a lot of money into my account, although I am also saving 8% into my KiwiSaver. So I'm building that up as much as I possibly can, because I got a very late start on KiwiSaver. The cool thing about KiwiSaver, though, is that it's very, very easy to track. Like, it is part of your bank account. You can transfer your KiwiSaver account into whatever bank you have. So if I'm with Co-op Bank, then I can make some calls or do some stuff on the internet and have my Kiwi account sort of show up as a sub account of my main co-op account. So then if I've got a mobile app or an internet app where I can go into an internet site is what they're called, where I can go into my bank and check my statements and things like that, which I think all modern banks pretty much have, then right there, along with my checking and my savings account, there's this Kiwi account, which, or KiwiSaver account rather, which you may be able to dump more money into it. So again, if you do have $200 left over at the end of the month, and you're thinking, well, I could either spend that on something frivolous, or I could do that responsible grown-up thing and put it into my KiwiSaver account. You can just throw it in there. It's as easy as a couple of mouse clicks. So it's a very direct, hands-on kind of thing. You cannot withdraw from it for stupid stuff, unless I think there are some pre-approved major purchases. Like if you want to buy a home, I believe you can actually take your KiwiSaver money and put it into your home or something like that, because it's considered, I guess, a big future kind of investment. So I'm not sure what the rules are. I haven't really looked all that much into it. All the point that I'm really trying to make is that Social Security and 401k shouldn't be as complicated as they are, unless maybe I've just somehow missed the, like I say, the class on how to manage that stuff. I just don't even understand how you're supposed to interface with them at all. Well, now I do, netbenefits.com, if your 401k is with Fidelity, but I didn't find that out till much later, and only by accident. I found that out by a completely different method, which I'm going to transition into now. So, direct methods of investing in your own future. As far as I know, there are basically two ways to do this. One is completely self, just your own resources. You, by sheer force of will and discipline, you save up money. It's possible. A lot of financial experts, oh, look at those air quotes, say that that's not very effective because you're not, you know, if you're just, if the analogy is always stuffing money under your mattress, right? It's not, you know, your money is not, again, air quotes, working for you. So you're just kind of, you're throwing it somewhere and it's not gaining interest. You're just relying on this money being there, like existing, and that's all you're doing. And it's not growing with you. And it's probably in some kind of economic theory probably says that it's actually devaluing because of inflation and stuff like that. I don't know. So however you want to manage that, that's up to you. Maybe you invest in, I don't know, gold or whatever. I'm not really sure how you protect your own investments. I don't know that sort of thing. But that is one method, is just by your own resources, you collect money. Now, I think probably the very middle of the road method of doing that is what is called a certificate of deposit or a mutual fund. And you've probably heard of these. They are really, really low risk, but also by the same token, they typically are low return investment that you can do at just your bank. You just go into your bank, you talk to one of the people, not like a teller, but like one of the people at the desks around the place that you always think, what do those people do all day? They look like they must be like bankers, whatever that means, but what do they do? Well, that's what they do. They sit around and wait for someone to come up to them and say, I want to invest and I don't know anything about investing. And then they say, okay, well, we'll open you a mutual, we'll get you into a mutual fund. And that's their job, I guess. And so CDs or certificate of deposits or mutual funds, they're very closely related, and there are minor differences that I'm not really too clear on. But a CD, as far as I know, is basically part of a mutual fund, and then a mutual fund is a bigger thing. I could be wrong on that. Again, if you know these sorts of things, you should do an HPR episode on it. But you can sign up, you can take some chunk of money. So let's say you've got, I don't know, let's say $1,000, because that way it's super simple math. So you got $1,000 and you think, I really, that's my retirement fund right now. So I should really put that $1,000 into something where my money will, quote unquote, work for me. And so you go to the bank, you ask to see one of the people at the desks, and you sit down and you say, hey, I want to invest my $1,000. And they look at you with like this little wry smile and they think, oh, how cute, this person thinks $1,000 is an investment. Well, that's good. And so they tell you encouraging and positive things like, oh, it's very good that you want to invest your money. And so then they sign you up for a certificate of deposit or a mutual fund or whatever. They ask you maybe, do you want to do high risk or low risk? And you say, well, low risk, I guess. And then they take your $1,000 out of your bank account. They put it into a certificate of deposit or a mutual fund. And pretty much you've just invested money in a stock market. The mutual fund, as far as I understand, are lots of little purchases of a bunch of different stocks. So rather than you sitting down and or going to the New York Stock Exchange and shouting into the air like they do in movies and invest and buy, sell, that sort of thing, you're just kind of you're giving money over to this sort of fuzzy group that manages mutual funds, and they just they push money around, and the money is fed by your certificate of deposit. So when they think, how much money as a bank or as a group, as a mutual fund, do we want to push over into this stock region? And usually it's a lot of different industries, right? So some they'll invest in oil, and but not too much oil, just a little bit of oil. And they'll invest in, I have no idea, that's the only thing I know people invest. Oh, technology. Not too much technology, just a little bit of technology. And then they invest in farming. Is that a thing? I don't know. And so you've got this nice little diverse thing. So as one market goes up, your money goes up, but then the other market's going down, so your money goes down. But you kind of hit this magical sort of middle ground where over the long term, over 6 months or a year, which is usually, those are usually the two standard frames of time that you're allowed to, you give your money away for. During that time, your money goes up some small percentage. And I swear I've had several of these certificates of deposits, and I used to think 0.8% was a lot of money. Like I would get my money back at the end of the thing, and it would be like $1,008, like 1008. And I would think, oh my gosh, that's amazing. I've made $8. And all I had to do was like, give my money over to the bank for 6 months. This is for a year. This is fantastic. And that was a big deal to me. And that's about the level of return that I've ever seen in a certificate of deposit. Now, your mileage may vary, and I might be misremembering. Point is that it's not going to, like, if you give them 1,000, you're probably not going to get 2,000 back in a year. It's not that level of investment. And that's just something to be aware of. It is, as many people have said, better than not investing it and just staying with your like little, you know, your 3% or 2% or whatever it is, savings account. There's a slight improvement, and there's not a whole lot of risk, and it's out of sight and out of mind, which is a pretty powerful trick if you're the sort of person who sees the, oh man, I've got like $3,000 in my savings account. This is really exciting. I could probably afford to take 1,000 out and spend it on this really nice getaway for the weekend because I'm poor and I deserve something nice. How dare you think that? So don't do that. Put it into your certificate of deposit and get $8 back after a year. You'll be so much happier as a poor person if you do that. Trust me. I'm sorry if I'm being sarcastic about all of this. As I said, money is not really one of those things that really interests or turns me on. It's something that I really am not a fan of. But anyway, point being, if you want to try to invest for your future, it is better than putting it into a mutual fund or a certificate of deposit is better than having it at your fingertips ready to be spent if you're that sort of person. And I guess by the numbers, it's better than just leaving it in a lower interest savings account or whatever, wherever you have your excess money, assuming you have excess money. Now, again, if you're sitting here saying, but Klaatu, I don't have the money to invest. Like, I don't even have $3,000 in my savings account. I don't have the spare $1,000 to put into a CD. Okay, so slow down. First of all, go back to the beginning of the show. As I said, in theory, you can reduce your expenditures, and then you can take that whatever excess money you do have from reducing your expenditures and putting it into some place where you cannot get to it to spend it. It is not easy. It is difficult, and it only gets more difficult as you go lower on the spectrum. If you are really, really poor, it is super, super hard to save anything at all because you're up against these hard ceilings of you don't have money. This is your zero balance, and that's it. And if you even go close to your zero balance, we're going to charge you more money for being too poor. Banks do that. It's a beautiful, beautiful system for the bankers. So I understand that it is very difficult, and the only advice I have really is to reduce expenditures. And if you're telling me you've reduced all of your expenditures and still have zero money, then you either don't have a job, or you need to start like dumpster diving for your food or something, or get another job where they feed you for free or something like that, because there's got to be some way where you can cut expenses so far back that you have something to start a savings account. Even if it's like, maybe it's not $1,000 at first, maybe it's like $10, and then next month it's $20, and then eventually you'll have like $1,000, and you can put that into a CD or a mutual fund. And it's a miserable, miserable existence. It's a horrible way to have to live, and I know that because I've been there. And all you have to do is keep at it, and it will be very, very discouraging. In like 3 years, you'll look at your financial state and you'll think, wow, I went from having barely $1,000 to my name to now $1,024, and it only took me 3 years. Well, this is exciting. But that's not your only vector of getting out of your situation. Like, that $1,000 is the savings. That's the emergency fund. There's other stuff in your life that you may be able to do, you know, learn some new skill to get a better job, that sort of thing. You know, it's, so don't look at that as your only escape from poverty. Oh, $1,024, that's That's going to get me rich in, I don't know, probably 2 million years. Well, that's not going to all happen from that $1,000. So don't look at it that way. Look at that $1,000 as you being disciplined and being able to save some money. Okay, so that's mutual funds and certificates of deposits. That, again, you just do at your regular bank. Wherever you go to deposit your paycheck or to withdraw money from your account or whatever you do at a bank, you probably don't even go to a bank anymore. You probably do it all online. But presumably there's some place in your city where your money is placed. And if you go there and you say, hey, I have a little bit of extra money, I would like to invest it in a CD or a mutual fund, they will guide you to the correct person to make that happen. Okay? Super simple. And as I've said, it's probably on the end of investment sort of how cool it is, it's pretty low. But it is very easy as well. So you've got that. All right. The more difficult and more advanced method of investing is directly into the stock market. Now, the stock market, everyone, when you say stock market, everyone thinks about the U.S. stock, the New York Stock Exchange. That's the stock market to most people. Now, that's actually not the only stock market. I mean, it is the stock market, but there are other stock markets. So in New Zealand, for instance, it's called the share market, the share market, I believe. And so you can go to this place in New Zealand and you can't, not a physical, well, I mean, I'm sure there's a physical place, but yeah, you go online and you can sign up and do all of these things in the share market. So you're investing in local industry and hopefully getting money back. The stock market itself, like the New York Stock Exchange, is kind of the big and famous one because it's, and not surprisingly, it's the most successful. I mean, there's a country of rampant capitalism. Yes, their market is really, really healthy. It's or unhealthy, the way depending on the way you look at it. But if you're there to make money, that's definitely a place to go. That is one of those things in life where popularity really, really matters. Because if you want to throw money around, you need to go to a place where there's lots of money to throw around. So that would be the U.S. stock market. Now, it's not necessarily super easy to get into the U.S. market from outside. I mean, I'm sure there are ways, and if you have enough money, I'm sure it gets infinitely easier for you to do that. Now, by some weird chance, I was born an American, so I have this free ticket into the U.S. stock market, and it's puzzlingly difficult, even if you're an American, to really get into the stock market. Like, how does that work? How do you invest? How do you take out, you know, how do you invest in a company? How do you get stocks? How do you buy? How do you sell? How do you trade stocks? Like, what is that all about? Well, there are lots of different ways to do this. And once again, if you're one of those people who knows a lot about this stuff, you should do a Hacker Public Radio episode on it, because I only know what I know. And the way that I found all of this stuff out was, if you get a job in the tech industry, at least when I was first getting jobs in the tech industry, then it was pretty standard for your employer to offer you stocks. Like, you were going to get employee stock, employee stock discount or something like that, ESDD or employee stock distribution. I'm not really sure, but it's some deal where you get stocks in the company that you work for. And that seems to be pretty common within the tech industry. I'm not saying it's all over the place, but I am saying that in many, many of the companies that I have worked within technology, I have gotten stock allotments. But you don't have to be employed in tech to get stock. You can do that obviously yourself. So how do you get stock, and how do you interact with stocks once you get them? Well, there are lots of different sites online that manage stocks, and it's part of the internet thing where you can actually, you know, you don't have to go to New York to Wall Street and go into that stock exchange place where you see on the movies. You don't have to go there and do stuff. You can just do it all from your living room. You can just do it, or if you're opting not to have a house, you can do it from the cafe. You can just do this online. A couple of different sites will help you with this. So there's Ameritrade, which I know nothing about, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, and E-Trade. Those are the four, as far as I know, those are the four big ones. They usually require at least about $1,000 investment, or like $1,000 starting deposit. And that's what all these places are, is they're online banks. I mean, they're probably more than that, but you can think of them as an online bank. They may or may not have a physical brick and mortar. I mean, they probably do somewhere, but not in your neighborhood. It's not something that you will go down to the shopping center and go into the place and sign up. It's something that you have to do online. Obviously, you would want to make sure that you're doing it with something that's fairly well known. So stick to the big ones. And if you're not sure which are the big ones, aside from the ones that I've just listed, Ameritrade, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, and E-Trade, then do some research and find out what's reliable. So what you do is you sign up with these guys and you make some kind of deposit. So they'll usually require you to verify that you have a bank account elsewhere, and then you will somehow transfer money from your bank to their bank. And how you do that will depend on what kind of infrastructure they have set up. And there are always those weird bank numbers that you have to throw around. And so there might be some phone calls involved. You might have to sort of get in there and really kind of wiggle things around and make things happen. But the initial setup will be a little bit of a chore. But after that, you're done. You've got a site. You've got an account on this website. So let's say you're with E-Trade So you're in E-Trade and you've got an account, and they have several different kinds of accounts. They have savings and checkings and brokerage. So maybe your $1,000 got put into your checking account. And from your checking account now, you can spend money at the stock market. And in order to do that, you would open a brokerage account, or possibly it'll already be there. But you would click in the brokerage section of the website and look up a stock symbol. So let's say that you want to invest in GNU World Order Incorporated. So you look up GNU World Order for their stock symbol, and it's GWO. Okay, cool. So you look at the GWO prices, and they are currently going for one share, which is an arbitrary division of a company. Like, they've, for whatever reason, GNU World Order Incorporated has decided that they have 100 shares to offer the public. They are willing to give 100 imaginary pieces of their company to the public. They have decided, or maybe the market has decided, that their 100, that for one share out of their 100, it's pretty reasonable to ask for $10. So that means that if you look on E-Trade or Fidelity or whatever you're using, and you look up GWO, and they're saying, okay, cool, so here's GWO, their current asking price for their shares, or the current trading price for a share of GWO is $10 per share. That means that you could take, in theory, you could take 20 of your dollars from your checking account, transfer it over to your brokerage, and issue a sell request, a buy request of two shares of GWO. Now that goes off into some kind of computer, and there's this request, and at some point a bid is placed on your behalf for two shares of GWO. Generally speaking, that happens. There's usually lots of shares out there. I would believe it was probably pretty rare for you to ask for a share of something and not be able to get it. And all of these prices are sort of dynamically created by the market. So if at noon you ask for two shares of GWO, and you're saying, well, it looks like they're worth 10 bucks, and so here's 20 bucks for two shares, then in theory, as long as GWO is a fairly stable kind of price, then you ought to just get two shares, and that's that. Now, you will probably be charged a little bit more than 20, because Fidelity or E-Trade or whatever site you're using will take their cut, right? They'll take a cut of your transaction. So they'll take your 20 and an extra $2 for their work. That's pretty standard. I don't know of a way around that. I mean, there is a way around that. You can go to New York, to Wall Street, and just do your own trading, I guess. But for us normal folk, that's part of doing business. And as long as you're not buying and selling like on a daily basis, those prices, you know, the cuts that you have to endure in order to make a sell or a buy transaction is not that big of a deal. So, and I guess that would be an argument for like buying lots at one time. You know, maybe that way you get sort of the cut gets taken out and it's sort of locked in at a certain price and you don't have to worry about it. I don't know. So you get two shares. So now you have two shares of GWO. Great. What do you do with it? Well, you don't do anything. Now you've basically assembled your own little minimal mutual fund on a very low level. Like, I mean, that's what it is. It's just an investment. You've got two shares of GWO. Now, the good news is that next year or 2 days from now, if GWO shoots up to $15 per share, like more people want their shares for some reason, people want to buy GWO, That makes your two shares look mighty good to somebody out there. That means that if you put it up for sale right now, you could expect to get $15 for it. So you paid 20 bucks for it, and if you sell two of them now, you're going to get 30 bucks back, or maybe 28 because of the transaction fee. But you're going to get more money for what you just... Now, the quandary there is, how much of this sort of transaction do you actually want to do? Do you want to sit there every day and watch the stock prices? And then there's this big question of, well, if you do that, how frequent are your updates? Are you seeing... I guess this is a big concern among people who do serious stock trading. They need to see price fluctuations like right now. And I imagine once, you know, if you're doing like thousands and thousands or hundreds of thousands of shares, just the barest fluctuation in the market may actually mean like $1,000 to you or $10,000 to you. It might be a big deal to, I think, normal people like you and me, well, me, then that's not going to matter. So if GWO goes up to $15 and I paid $10, I'm probably realistically just going to sit there and think, cool, I have more imaginary money than I had yesterday. And that's the extent of it. Now, ideally, and I think the long-term investment kind of mentality is, ideally, in 20 years, those shares are going to go from 10, they'll go up to 15, then they'll go back down to 12, then they'll go up to 17, then they'll go back out to down to 10, then they'll go up to 20, and then maybe they'll go back down to 8, and you'll be really sad for a day, and then they'll go back up to 30, and now you're starting, you know, over 20 years, you look back, you walk away, and you come back in 20 years, and you look at your investment, and you think, oh my gosh, instead of, I paid $20 for these things back in 2018, and here it is in 2038, and not only have all the clocks stopped, but it looks like I've got $1,000 now, and it was a mere $20 20 years ago. How exciting is that? So that's the theory, that in some allotment of time, the level of growth will be so great that it'll all have paid off for you. Now, realistically, you probably don't want to do that with just two stocks of some random company. Prevailing theory seems to be that you should buy stocks in several different companies, some here, some there, different kinds of industries, all that other sort of thing. So you are kind of building your own mutual fund, right? You're investing a little bit in technology, you're investing a little bit in something else, and you sort of gather stocks, you collect them over time. And some lose money and some gain money and some lose money and some gain money. And at the end of it all, in 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 years, you can look back at that and say, well, all of those stocks have, you know, cumulatively, they have now earned me a lot of money, and that is the fund upon which I am going to retire. That's the theory. I don't know if it works. I'm not there yet. But I do know that stocks are something that you can invest in, and it's a very direct kind of investment. It takes a little bit more effort than everything else that we've talked about so far, because you do have to go find a stock trading website. And now in reality, you can also go and you can find a broker. Like, you can actually contact someone who does this all day and will take your money and play with it. They'll invest with it, they'll make money, and they'll manage it for you. They'll take their cut, just like the websites do, and they will do that. That is something that you can hire people to do those things, and they will manage that for you. Now, whether or not you have enough money for them to bother is a different question entirely. Some brokerages they don't want to deal with you unless you're bringing $100,000 to the table. Otherwise, it's just not worth their time. They're not going to make the amount of money that they want to make on a fund like that. So to some degree, I think the internet website sort of manual trading is probably your first step. That's probably the way toward stocks initially. Now, the nice thing about the tech industry, where they throw stocks at you as part of your paycheck, is that they generally sell you, they grant you the stock at a lower price than the selling price. So let's say that GWO has jumped up to $20 per share, and they've now started hiring an employee. And so their employee, they say, well, we'll pay you this much, and we'll give you a stock thing as well. So to their employee, they give a $20 stock to their employee for 10, you know, at as if though the employee had bought it at 10. So they'll take 10 of your paycheck money and give you a $20 stock for it. So right off the bat, you've made $10. So if you turn around and sold that stock today, you would make you'd get your $10 that you were supposed to get in your paycheck anyway, plus another 10. So that's nice, and that's one of those options that if you are in the tech industry and you hear a buzz about how you can get employee stocks and stuff like that, it's definitely something to look into because that is apparently a good deal. Okay, so again, the trading thing, I mean, there's this thing called day trading where some people will go on and they will buy a stock on Monday and they will watch that stock, and if it goes up by Friday, they will sell that stock. And so they will take the $10 the $10 increase on those stocks that they got from Monday to Friday, and that's their transaction. And now they've made $10 or whatever. They've made $100. However many stocks we're talking about. You don't have to do it that way, and a lot of people don't. I think for a lot of people, stock is just, it's a long-term investment where you dump money into these fluctuating industries that go up and go down, but you invest in enough different industries that it all averages out in the end to a total, to an overall gain for you. And in the end is 20 or 40 or 60 years from when you start investing. It's something that you can do. It's something that you can go into and kind of manage and monitor. It's a little bit harrowing because, like I say, if you've got stocks and they're there and you can see them, they'll go up, they'll go down. You won't know. It'll be very confusing if you're not used to it, and it'll be a little bit upsetting, possibly. I mean, certainly when I first got my tech stocks from one of the mini companies now that I've been paid in stocks by, I would occasionally go in and look at it and not really know what it was all about. I didn't even know at the time that I had access to it. I just knew that I could look. And so I would look at the prices and they would go up and then they'd go down, and it was a roller coaster, you know? Like one day I'd think, oh my gosh, I'm rich now. I'm totally rich. I could retire. And then the next, not really. And then the next day, it's lower, and I think, oh no, I've lost $3,000 overnight. Well, it's $3,000 I didn't really even have in the first place. It was the asking price for these things. So it's all very hazy and abstract and theoretical, and it's a terrible way to live, but it is an investment that you can make. That's the stock market. Mutual funds or certificate of deposits, a step down from there. And then, of course, as I say, 401k, Social Security, who knows what those even are. I don't know how to get into the U.S. stock market from outside the U.S. I do know, as I've said, in other countries, there are other stock markets or share markets or some kind of market. You may be able to invest in those. Now, in New Zealand, as far as I can tell, the share market is something that is for high-ranking investors. Like they don't, I cannot find any information on investing locally unless you are investing lots and lots of money. Maybe I'm just not looking in the right place, but if you want to invest in New Zealand directly, I cannot find a way to do that other than some brokers up north, and all of them flat out on their website say, hey, if you don't have $100,000, don't even bother knocking on our door. So I don't know really what the situation is outside of the U.S. stock market, and even the U.S. stock market, I'm not really too clear on all the details. So again, take all of my advice as experiential advice. I'm not trained in economics. I'm not trained in business. I don't know how money works, and I don't even like money. So really take everything that I have said with care, grain of salt, but do your homework, research this topic, and as they say, start now, because if you start saving now, then you'll be that much farther along later. And if you don't ever see yourself retiring, as I pretty much don't see myself retiring, if you never see yourself retiring, then that's fine. But even so, build up some kind of emergency fund for yourself, because even if you think, well, I don't even want to retire, I wouldn't know what to do if I did retire. You just never know what's going to happen. You don't know if you're going to get sick and you're going to need money to fall back on. You don't know if the housing market's going to drop and you should have bought that apartment or that house when you had a chance, whatever. I don't know. The future is uncertain. You may want to have some money sort of built up to buffer against unforeseen circumstances. What about the argument that the future is so uncertain that possibly money will be meaningless because of some cataclysmic event? Yes, there is that argument as well. Good on you. So do your research, do what you need to do for finances. Most importantly, though, talk about it. Like get people's input, get people's strategies, listen to other people, look at how they're doing, and really really try to figure this stuff out for yourself, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of maliciously disinformation out there, and there's a lot of just kind of omission, like lots of people not talking about it at all. And I don't know if that's because they don't understand it or if that's just because they don't want you in on the good thing that they have. I'm really not clear on why people just don't get any kind of guidance about finances in this life. But start thinking about it if you want to, and try to plan for the future. Hopefully this has helped a little bit, and if you have more information on this, by all means, do a Hacker Public Radio episode. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club, and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.